This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Christmas movies occupy a special place in our hearts. Sometimes a sickeningly sweet place, you know, sugar plums and all that. But, well, It's a Wonderful Life. Well, there's sweetness to be sure, but there's also war, poverty, shattered dreams, alcoholism, and let's not forget the threat of
bankruptcy and scandal and prison.
So today, a trip to Bedford Falls to look at just how George Bailey became the richest man in town on Christmas Eve, 1945. Just how wonderful a life is it? Murray Horowitz joins us in just a moment. Later on, as the recession swells the ranks of those in need, a parish priest in England reconsiders Thou Shall Not Steal. But first, what lesson from It's a Wonderful Life resonates with you most this Christmas? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Murray Horowitz joins us here in Studio 3A, as he does most Christmases, Christmas Eve this year. He's talking the nation's favorite film buff. Nice to have you back, Murray.
Good to be back, Neil.
And we all know the ending of this movie, but we forget this is a terrifying film.
It really is. Any great, you know, I guess ultimately you'd have to say it's a comedy. And any great comedy, as you learn in Drama 101, implies at least a bleak side of life, a dangerous side, a tough side, an unkind side of life. And every time I see this movie, and how can one avoid it, mm-hmm. or you just see a scene from it, you forget. You think of it as kind of Christmas treacle, but it's not at all.
Listen to how the Scrooge of the film, and that's Mr. Potter, who owns the big bank in town. Listen to how Mr. Scrooge of the film sums up the life of George Bailey quite accurately.
George Bailey is not the common, ordinary yokel. He is an intelligent, smart, ambitious young man who hates his job, who hates the building and loan almost as much as I do. A young man who's been dying to get out on his own ever since he was born. A young man, the smartest one in the crowd, mind you. A young man who has to sit by and watch his friends go places because he's trapped. Yes, sir, trapped into frittering his life away playing nursemaid to a lot of garlic eaters. Do I paint a correct picture? Or do I exaggerate?
Oh, Lionel Barrymore.
And he doesn't exaggerate at all. It's interesting. George Bailey does not answer him directly. I mean, because he knows he's told the truth.
Well, that moment he is at his wit's end.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, by the way, it is one of the great Scrooges. It's one of the ironies of the film because that's Lionel Barrymore. And he did one of the great characterizations of Ebenezer Scrooge in a famous radio adaptation of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. It's established very early on in this film that the world is filled with idiots, you know, the druggist, Mr. Gower, and Uncle Billy, with death. You know, there's the telegram about Gower's son dying. George's brother almost dies.
First scene, yeah, George's brother almost dies, and he goes deaf.
That's right, exactly.
In one ear.
And there's superstition. You know, he has that little lighter. He goes, you know, I wish I had $1 million. Hot dog. You know, yeah. It's without going too far, one of the things that makes this an American classic is it's a really kind of de Tocquevillian synthesis of Hobbes and Locke. Our life is short, brutish, and nasty, but there's this kind of social contract by which everything kind of gets negotiated in a cheerful way. And ultimately, it's an optimistic film.
Well, after teaching us the lesson that if you fall in love with a beautiful girl in town, your father will die, George Bailey then is on his way out of town and goes to the meeting where Mr. Potter tries to dissolve the building and loan. And, of course, George then does answer Mr. Potter.
Very directly.
Do you know how long it takes a working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter, that this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath? Anyway, my father didn't think so.
Well,
and it's a very significant plot moment because Frank Capra, the director and co-author of the script, and the producer of the film, is an independent production in 1946, has said that this was his favorite film. And he said in many ways it's because it was the distillation of all of his films. It's about the importance of the individual. And in that scene, just by making that short speech in which he says he's gone on too long, he changes everybody's mind. And Mr. Potter is voted down.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. In what way does It's a Wonderful Life, A Nation at War, Panics at the Banks, You Can't Get the Home Repairs Done, how does it echo in your life these days?
Sounds familiar.
800-989-8255. Email us, talk at npr.org. Rob's on the line from Murfreesboro in Tennessee.
Yes, we did our annual watching of It's a Wonderful Life this past week, and as someone that has just recently hit 50, a part that struck me now that didn't in the past was how it's okay not to have met your dreams, because we're not alone in that, and you have to take joy in what's around you.
Your dreams, of course, George Bailey's dream is also to get out of this, get out of this town.
He never gets there. And Rob, you said we. Does that include young people?
It's cautionary to young people, because I've got a freshman in college, and he just knows that he's going to go out there and whip the world.
We could play him, in fact, this very speech from George Bailey.
Mary, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow and the next day and next year and a year after that. I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world. Italy, Greece, the Parthenon, the Colosseum. Then I'm coming back here and go to college and see what they know. And then I'm going to build things.
Build great things. Mm. And, well, Rob, of course, he doesn't get to do that. He gets to build the building alone.
Yep, that's it. He just always is the nice guy, having to do the right thing at the sacrifice of what he knew in his heart he was really meant to do.
And how did your son react to the lesson?
he just poo-poos it and doesn't want to watch it.
He may be very fond of it 20 years from now.
Thanks. We can only hope.
Thanks very much for the call, Rob, and Merry Christmas to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And while we're always glad to have Murray's encyclopedic movie mind, we also have invited the person who literally wrote the book on this movie. Janine Basinger is the curator of the Capra Archives and the author of the It's a Wonderful Life book, and she joined us by phone now from her home in South Dakota. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I'm very interested in the conversation, of course.
And do you think of this as a Christmas movie?
No, I think of this as the downer of the universe. Every time I see it, I bang my head on the wall. I don't think of it as a Christmas movie, but, interestingly, it wasn't intended to be a Christmas movie. It was shoved into the Christmas release of 1946 because RKO's Big Escape movie, their Technicolor production of Sinbad the Sailor, wasn't ready for release. And so it didn't do very good business over Christmas in its first release, which has sort of given rise to the idea that it was a financial failure, which it actually wasn't. It wasn't the big success financially that Capra's films usually were.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't lose money. But it's a sad movie, and in many ways. And when I always say that it became a Christmas movie through television.
Yeah, that's where I first saw it. As an oddity, I was the only one in my house not allowed to go out that year on New Year's Eve, and caught this movie in the best possible way, knowing nothing about it, on a black and white TV, sitting alone, feeling terribly sorry for myself, and just absolutely entranced.
You see, that's the whole thing. I mean, people are, despite our insane attempts to pretend we're riotously happy during the holidays, I mean, most people, it's a time, the end of the year, you're examining your life, you're thinking about what you've done, you return to home, to your family. There's many good things are happening for people, and yet it is a time when most people do what the caller said. You know, you think about, well, how old am I now? What have I done? Did I ever get out of town? Have my dreams come true?
I'll never play second base for the Yankees.
Exactly. And I'll never be point guard for the Boston Celtics. and that's been tough, let me tell you.
Me too. Yeah.
I have to say, because even though you use the word encyclopedic, it got to take at least 1 second, Neil, to say that we're on the phone with Janine Basinger, who is one of the great teachers of film, scholars of film in the United States. And so I'm humbled before you, Janine.
Oh, that's so sweet.
I do have a question, though, about the script, because there are rumors that I found online and stories about how when Capra got the project, there were a couple of scripts already attached to it, and names were thrown around like Dorothy Parker and Clifford Odets and Dalton Trumbo. Did these people actually have any kind of hand in the writing of it?
When Capra bought the project, there were three scripts that had already been done. Initially, it was purchased by RKO as a possible project for Cary Grant. But they couldn't ever get a script that worked. I mean, it does present, you know, talking angels and stuff. You know, I mean, it does present some issues. And what they had actually purchased was just a little tiny story that had been on a Christmas card. But there were original scripts done, and one was Clifford Odets, one was Dalton Trumbo, and Mark Conley, not Dorothy Parker.
But those are three pretty, those are heavyweights.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and they couldn't crack it. I mean, they just couldn't get it right, and it went through a lot of transitions and a lot of writing and rewriting until they finally came up with this, and Capra purchased it for only $10,000. And he, of course, immediately thought of it as being for Jimmy Stewart. He never considered anyone but Stewart.
He was right.
$10,000, that's double the price of a home in
Bedford Falls.
Bedford Falls, yeah.
The other thing is that the people who are credited with him are Francis Goodrich and Albert Hackett, a husband and wife writing team, who were writers of extraordinary technical as well as emotional and intellectual range. I mean, they not only did westerns and musicals and sort of film noir, but they did, but great ones. I mean, they did The Diary of Anne Frank, and they wrote The Thin Man, and they wrote Easter Parade, and they wrote The Virginian. They were amazing.
Well, after reading the book The Thin Man, I could have written the script for The Thin Man. Come on.
If you'd had William Powell and Myrna Loy.
Well, yeah, that's all I needed. But anyway.
Asta makes it.
Asta makes the whole movie.
Asta, better known as Skippy. Skippy was actually, Skippy played Asta. Let's not forget.
All right. Well, and got all the good dialogue anyway. But Janine Basinger, hold on. We're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back with Murray Horwitz. We're talking about It's a Wonderful Life, which taught us any number of things.
Every time you hear a bell rings, it means that some angel's just got his wings.
I never knew that before. What a lesson from It's a Wonderful Life. What lesson from the film resonates with you most this Christmas? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tonight it's Christmas Eve. No better time to look back at the movie that immortalized one man's very difficult December 24th, George Bailey. We're talking with Murray Horwitz. He's Talk of the Nation's favorite film buff, as well as with Janine Basinger, who wrote the It's a Wonderful Life book and curates the Capra Archives. What's the lesson from It's a Wonderful Life that resonates most with you this Christmas? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And let's go next to Dave. And Dave's with us from Rochester in New York.
Hey, gentlemen. How are you?
Very well,
great.
Thanks.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thanks for taking my call. Well, here in Rochester, we're really lucky. We have a place called the George Eastman House. And we have a huge, they have a huge film archive. And just last night, they screened It's a Wonderful Life on the big screen. And the thing was, I went there and they had to turn people away. There were hundreds and hundreds of people. And the great part was, it was just an audience of some little kids, from little 5-6-year-old kids all the way to octogenarians. We were all sitting together watching this movie in a packed movie house. And it just felt so good that everybody was there together enjoying it. At the end of the movie, everyone's, you know, people are wiping tears and smiling and talking to each other. And
but Dave, what lesson did you take away from this?
I will tell you, the lesson that I took from the film, not only that, you know, it is in fact a wonderful life, but I did learn that if, in fact, you do not, as a woman, get married and have a children and a husband, you turn into a spinster librarian, apparently.
Right, a fate worse than death.
And that was the one thing that put him over the top. It was, you know, you're not going to like this, George. You're not going to like this.
You're not going to like this. Donna Reed's not going to like you.
Right.
Exactly. And she was, you know, you turn frumpy. It's sad.
It is. It is. Donna Reed played a very convincing frumpy. She was also really very, very pretty.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. But it was a wonderful film, and, you know, I watch it every year, and every year I cry, and it's part of the tradition.
Well, you not only have the wonderful Eastman Institute there, but a great radio station, WXXI.
Absolutely. Thank you, gentlemen. Have a wonderful holiday.
Thank you,
bye-bye. I wonder, Janine, what did Capra think of this movie?
Well, he was very proud of it. First of all, he liked it in the first place and felt it was his magnum opus, as Murray had said, or one of you said earlier. But what he said to me, and he often said to my students, was it had a strange original afterlife, that although it was nominated for Oscars, it didn't win any, but he started getting an unusually high number of letters about it. And he said, I sat down to write an answer to a letter in 1947, and when I got up, it was 1967. For 20 years, people just wrote me and wrote me and wrote me, and he said, I finally realized that this film, as much or more than any other film I made, touched people. They might hate it, they might love it, but they couldn't let it alone. And one of the things I notice in the archive, that I always say, it's the silly season, we take bets. Is it going to be October 25th? Is it going to be November 3rd? When is the first request for an interview going to come? And also, when are we going to get the first angry letter telling us we're idiots because we like it? Or it's amazing. It continues to live. I mean, it has a vibrant life, as the caller described so beautifully, that big, full audience in that wonderful theater at Eastman House. It's amazing, really.
Now let's get Charlie on the line. Charlie with us from Wichita.
Yes, on that very subject, I have a two-page little bread-and-butter response from Frank Capra, because I wrote to him in 1975, and like you, I sat and watched it all by myself on a little black-and-white TV. And I was so taken with it. I have no idea where I got his mailing address, because it was before the internet. So that I have no clue about. But he starts off in the letter apologizing for taking so long to reply.
Yes,
but he's been out on the circuit, on the college circuit, and he tells me in this little letter just how blown away he is by this newest generation's love of his movie. And I might point out that apparently Jim Henson, it's one of his favorite movies, too.
Ah, I did not know that.
When you consider Bert and Ernie.
Right. Sure, yeah, absolutely.
The cop and the taxi driver. Bert and Ernie, right.
Not the cab driver and the conventioneer. That was something completely different. Charlie, thanks very much for the call.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye. Janine Basinger, thank you so much for your time today.
It was my pleasure and wonderful to hear. I guarantee you that Charlie's letter is in our archive, because Frank saved every one of those letters. They meant a great deal. Thanks for having me on, and Murray, lots of love to you and your family.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to you.
Bye-bye.
Janine Basinger wrote the It's a Wonderful Life book. She's chair of the Film Studies Program at Wesleyan University and joined us today from her home in South Dakota. And let's see if we can get another caller in. This is Glenn. Glenn with us from Staunton in Wisconsin.
Yes, I had to call in when I found out you were talking about this movie. I've seen it in the hundreds of times, I believe, and it was actually the theme for my wedding.
Really?
Oh my gosh!
Did you have a basketball floor that opened up with a pool underneath?
Did they play Buffalo Gals?
I believe we did play Buffalo Gals. Yes, and we asked if everyone could dress in black and white. We had the little Liberty Bell that the Liberty Films at the beginning of the movie that people needed to ring when they wanted us to kiss. One other thing, during a very depressed period of my life, I received a letter anonymously which quoted the quote that Clarence writes in Tom Sawyer,
right,
in the book about no man is a failure who has friends, and I never did find out who sent that to me.
Hmm.
But one other thing, I'd read a book by Danny Peary about cult films, and he points out that the moments in this movie where most people cry are actually happy moments. The things that precede them are so dark that it's explosively cathartic when Mr. Gower hugs young George Bailey, or
yeah. Yes,
it's an important point, Glenn, because this is something that my filmmaker son points out. He says that Capra earns the happy ending. So many of the treacly Christmas films that you know that are churned out every season, it seems, don't last and don't have this kind of life of their own, as Janine Basinger pointed out. What happens is that they flourish in a day and die in a day. But this one, there's so much of the bleak side of life in it that when happy things, good things do happen, it's redemptive, and we recognize them, I think, and that's we cry with recognition. I'll stop there.
All right, Glenn. Did anybody get their wings at your wedding, by the way?
I guess my wife and I did.
Well, congratulations. That's nice. Thanks very much for the call. Last year, Wendell Jameson wrote an essay in the New York Times looking back on the tougher parts of this film. It's called Wonderful, Sorry, George, It's a Pitiful, Dreadful Life. In it, he writes that when he was 15, he was struck by the sequence where George sees what Bedford Falls would have become if he'd never been born. It has become Pottersville. Pottersville is packed with nightclubs, burlesque halls, gambling dens, and, well, when George comes to the old building and loan site, it's now dime a dance. Violet Bick is being dragged out of it. She's a dime dancer now, and, well, maybe something
worse.
We
know what that means. Right?
Wendell Jameson is deputy metropolitan editor of the New York Times. He joins us today from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And yet in your article, you say Pottersville seems like a lot of fun.
It seems like so much more fun than Bedford Falls to me now and when I was 15. The Indian Room and all the various bamboo cocktail lounge.
Right.
It's terrific. It's packed with people. It's vibrant. And it's an exciting town. I'd go there now if I had the chance.
The women are hot. The music swings and the fun times go on all night.
Right, absolutely. Right. And another thing that's interesting, I think, though, more seriously, if you look at the history of manufacturing in upstate New York since World War II, you know, George helped build the various factories in Bedford Falls. They've all go down the tubes, but an entertainment mecca upstate, something like Saratoga, is still thriving. So the truth of the matter is Pottersville or Bedford Falls may have been better off without George Bailey in the long run economically.
I could only say, in defense of Bedford Falls, that Pottersville would have probably been driven out of business by an Indian casino next door.
I mean, there were Pottersvilles, I guess. I mean, you know, like East St. Louis, Illinois did not do particularly well in the 1950s and 60s and 70s.
Your article also mentions the thing that everybody can relate to. A lot of this story is about the money pit of a house.
Absolutely. You know, when I was 15, you know, I maybe focused a little bit more on the concept of Donna Reed being naked behind a bush. But now that I'm in my 40s and own a condo, I think, my God, how is he ever going to fix up that house?
Right.
Can you imagine the cost overruns and the contractors and the subcontractors and the leaks and the electricians? Oh, my God, it's terrible.
This is how he confronts the situation when at the beginning of the movie he's realizing that, well, he's just got a million things to fix.
Of course, it's this old house. I don't know why we don't all have pneumonia. The drafty old barn of a place. Might as well be living in a refrigerator. Why do we have to live here in the first place and stay around this measly, crummy old town?
George, what's wrong?
Wrong everything, George. You call this a happy family. Why do we have to have all these kids?
Dad, how do you spell Frankenstein?
I don't know. Why, ask your mother.
Why do we have to have all these kids?
They haven't figured it out.
Yeah. It is the house that is a character. Of course, earlier on in the film, they have to throw rocks through the windows for good luck and wishes.
One of the things I like about the film is that there's a kind of, I think everything that you say, Wendell, of course, is correct. But it acknowledges that life is a negotiation and what we achieve at best is a kind of negotiated happiness between, you know, it reminds me, maybe this is why it's such an American document, It's a Wonderful Life. The great jazz scholar Albert Murray has said, the thing about the blues is the blues are ultimately optimistic. And you sing the blues to get rid of the blues, that life is a low-down, dirty, rotten shame, shouldn't happen to a dog. So you can either sit and stew about that, or you can shine your shoes and get ready to stomp at the Savoy at 9 o'clock.
Well, and I have to ask you, Wendell Jameson, though, George Bailey, we admire George Bailey. He's got tremendous qualities, but he is also tremendously flawed. In fact, he tries to kill himself.
He's flawed, and he's very angry. He's filled with rage.
He can be very nasty.
This is a guy, very nasty. He's nasty to the Mary character from the minute you meet them in the drugstore. What she ever saw in him is beyond me. He's in a rage throughout the whole film. And even at the end, we talk about the happy ending. Well, let's take a step back a minute. Okay, so everybody in the town raises $8,000 so he doesn't have to go to jail. And the next day, he may have to go to jail anyway, by the way. I'm not sure that restitution would have necessarily gotten him out of that jam. But let's just say he does. The next day, he has to go back to work, doesn't he? back to the building alone. And $8,000 that he maybe could have used to take a trip or do something great with his life, he had to use just to, because of dumb Uncle Billy losing that money. I mean, it's a very temporary Band-Aid happy ending. His miserable life, I'm afraid. And I almost think that the title, It's a Wonderful Life, is almost sarcastic. His life is not going to be that great the next day. It's back to the building and loan, man.
You mentioned he loses his temper with Uncle Billy, understandably.
Frank, I can't think anymore, George. I can't think anymore. It hurts.
Where's that money, you silly, stupid old fool? Where's that money? You realize what this means? It means bankruptcy and scandal and prison. That's what it means. One of us is going to jail. Well, it's not going to be me.
Yeah, well, this reminds you of the scene in The Maltese Falcon. One of it's going over, and it's not me.
Right.
But it is. Uncle Billy, well, he did lose the money. Well, Mr. Potter stole it, but it is...
Mr. Potter was accidentally given it. He kind of kept it. I'm not sure he quite stole it.
Well, I think you'd have a hard time proving that to the judge, too.
Well, once he sees the film...
I don't think he committed a crime. I don't think Potter committed a crime.
You don't think, really?
Uncle Billy handed it to him. He didn't take it. He didn't pull it out of his pocket or anything. There's no crime there. It's not illegal to be a dishonest citizen, is it?
Man, I'm not putting my stocking up in your living room. I got news for you.
Yet you also say, Wendell Jameson, this is one of your favorite movies.
I love this movie. I think it's a great movie. I just think it's a scary horror movie. A lot of people love horror movies. And I think having seen it many dozens of times, including just this last weekend in preparation for this interview, it's such a well-made movie. There's so many layers in it. There's so many little tiny weird things that you only notice on the 10th or the 20th or the 30th viewing.
Yeah, it's very true.
Mari and I have been going back and forth about all the character actors in that
picture. And one of the things I noticed seeing it this morning, Wendell, in preparation for this, is at the scene where he destroys the model bridge and he's almost ready to go out and kill himself, you look over his shoulder and Jimmy Stewart has behind him a portrait of Abraham Lincoln. And then in the next scene, or a couple scenes later, he goes to meet with Mr. Potter, and Potter has a bust of Napoleon.
Yes, I saw that. I saw that this weekend for the same time, too. And also, behind him, near his bridge, he has portraits, photographs of Uncle Billy, his mom, everyone he sees every day.
Yep.
No wonder he's out of his mind. He can't get away from these people. And another cool thing I noticed in that scene you very first used this afternoon when Mr. Potter is talking about what a smart guy George is. They shoot from over Lionel Barrymore's shoulder and you see George. And right on the desk is this little tiny, like shrunken head, screaming monkey skull.
Yeah, it's a skull.
It's bizarre. My wife noticed it. It's just bizarre and creepy on so many levels, and I love it.
Wendell Jameson, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Wendell Jameson wrote an essay in the New York Times last year titled "Wonderful, Sorry, George, It's a Pitiful, Dreadful Life," in which he argued it's a horror movie. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we get one last caller in. And let's go quickly to Pat. Pat with us from Wilmington, North Carolina.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I am in Wilmington, North Carolina, and it's home of Screen Gem Studio, Frank Capra Jr.'s movie industry here. And we have been fortunate over the past few years. He's been showing this on the big screen here at the university at UNCW.
And I don't mean to hurry you, but what lesson do you draw from the film this year?
Well, it's just been wonderful that, and you guys need to get over it. You have no idea what kind of lives you touch, how many people are influenced by your life, and the very fact that we're talking about this movie however many years later just indicates to me that we all have an opportunity to make a difference and to influence people in a positive way.
And Pat, that's a wonderful lesson. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
And we'll end with this email from Barbara. It's a Wonderful Life was my former spouse's favorite movie. He died 5 years ago after succumbing to alcoholism and prescription drug addiction. I spent the last 5 years raising our son, knowing what the world is like now that my former spouse is no longer part of it. If only he'd followed George Bailey's example. And by the way, it is a wonderful life. And of course, Murray,
great.
At the end, George is still the envy of us all.
To my big brother, George, the richest man in town.
Murray, thanks so much for being with us
today.
Thank
you so much, Neil. It's the lesson of that film to me is always good, which is never be discouraged.
Murray Horwitz, talk of the nation's favorite film buff. He joined us here in Studio 3A.
That's a Christmas present from a very dear friend of mine.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right.
Attaboy, Clarence.